You are listening to Fanthatrax.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
Hello, and welcome to episode 122 of Making Tracks, brought to you by those fine folk over at fanfortracks.com. As Mr. Mark Daniels has already said in the intro, my name's Mark, I'm one of your co-hosts, and joining me this week, as always, is that son of a Bamfa, the head of a Fanfers, Mr. Mark Newbold. Mark, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, I've never been described as that before, but I'll take it. That's kind of cool. Yeah, I'm very well, mate. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, dude. Yeah, all over my cold, all over my sniffles. So, yes, ready to rock and roll and talk about the Book of Boba Fett, Chapter 2.
No, I can't wait to get into that. I so enjoyed it. I think it's making a lot of Star Wars fans very happy at the moment.
Yes, happy Star Wars fans. It's kind of a name of the game, you would think.
And a rarity.
Exactly, and a rarity of that, yeah. So cool, man. How's your week in Star Wars been?
It's been a busy one. I have got loads of writing on, and Fantha's always busy. So we've got loads of content from Farthest Farm, as people know. So Brian's been editing the videos, and I've been posting them up on the site and getting that all organised and ready. We've been rolling those episodes out here on Making Tracks as well. So there's one more to come. There's the Brian Herring interview to come, hopefully next week. So that's all been keeping us busy.
Wicked. Have you had any new Star Wars stuff this week?
I'm looking around. I've got my copy of Fallen Star, which I'm looking forward to having a good roll through. And a few other little bits and bobs, but nothing crazy. Oh, I did get the Lucasfilm did a 50th anniversary pin that was supposed to be crew only. Managed to acquire one of those, which I'm rather chuffed about.
Nice.
So that's nice. So that's, I might put a picture online later, but that's looking really nice in sort of the little Lucasfilm cabinet. But I will tell you one thing I got. I'm going to reach over and grab it.
Go on, then.
I'm taking it out of the envelope. Now, Lucasfilm, for the last few years, obviously with everything that's been going on with the world, haven't been doing physical Christmas cards that they send out to people. ILM, I don't believe, have done physical cards for a long time, but they do online cards. Mm-hmm. So for the last two Lucasfilm, what would have been physical Christmas cards, my wonderful wife Ruth has managed to go to Moonpig or one of those kind of places and get them when I've sent her the image and sort of crafted an interior that looks like the inside of a card. And she's got them printed up. So I do actually have them. They're completely homemade.
That is a cracking idea.
The quality of the pictures has come out really well. So I do sort of, they're not real, but I do have them on display so people can look at them. And ILM did a really nice one this year. And this is a podcast, but I'm describing it. It's Jabba's Palace, but it's almost like a snow-covered Jabba's Palace.
Oh, nice.
And at the bottom, it's Boba Fett with a Santa's hat on and loads of great big presents. And there's Indiana Jones's hat. Yeah, three Jawas all sort of trying to grab hold of these presents. And it's really cute. So again, thank you, Ruth, because you got this all done for me, put together. So I'm going to put that up in the collection later. So it's not really a thing. But it is.
It is
made with love, so I'm very appreciative. So it's very nice.
That's really nice. And because, you're right. I got the Lucasfilm Christmas card emailed to me, which I shared with the rest of the Rebels for Elstree Base, and I think a lot of people appreciated that. That's really nice. I might have to nick that idea and do that myself. So I had, this week, I just had some action figures. Well, in fact, you say that, I had Fallen Star as well. That's arrived, and I believe I'm still waiting on my Goldsboro books version as well. But other than that, from Star Action Figures, I picked up Wave 38 Vintage Collection for Wave, which had Emperor Palpatine, Lando in his Bespin Blues, Tebow, and I think IG-11. Also, the Power of the Force 2 50th Anniversary Lucasfilm 6-inch Greedo figure, which came from Hasbro Pulse. But apart from that, the only thing I really did this week was I tidied up my collection room. You know how it's trying to find space and stuff? And I did find space for books basically by moving a lot of the Legends kind of reference books into a plastic container. And then I finished it, and I was just like, what you should have done is you should have left space for Razor Crest. But I just didn't. And now I'm thinking I'm going to have to do this all over again when this bloody box turns up, whenever that is.
I'm a bit nervous about that, though, because they did say that's January, February time, isn't it? That's imminent.
I had an email from Zavi this week. I think they basically said we're still trying to obtain it, you know, which is kind of nice because it means that they haven't completely forgotten about it, because they have started to land in people's collections, at least in the States. I don't know if they've made them any further out than that yet, but at least in the States, I think there's a few people who have kind of got them and stuff, so can't wait to get mine.
Yeah, I'm at that point. And it's similar to you with the collection room. And I can't wait for you to come over and see my collection room. Yeah. I've seen yours. It's a big room, but you know how it is. You soon fill it. I'm at the point now where I've got the staircase going up and I really want to get it shelved.
Yeah.
Because there's loads of stuff I can get off the floor in the other room. And then I can sort of have a rethink. I've got a part of the spare room I can use as well. So I want to get all the non-Star Wars stuff in the spare room and then all the Star Wars stuff from there upstairs. But using the stairs it feels like a no-brainer at the moment. And I've had this room up there for 8-9 years. That still feels like a new room, but it's 8 or 9 years. It's ridiculous. I really need to get these stairs done because space is a premium. It's crazy. You know, like you say, where are you going to put that Razor Crest? It's a big box.
I can just see what's going to happen is I'm going to have to stick it on the floor and then just bury it with other stuff. I won't have space to have it out and I won't even have space to display it. But, you know, me and Karen have been talking about extensions and like a loft conversion. We're looking at all that kind of stuff, not primarily for the collection, but ultimately if I can get a bigger space, that would obviously swing me one way or the other. But it's one of those first world Star Wars collector crisis, yes, isn't it? And, you know, everybody, yeah, kind of goes through it at one stage or another. And it doesn't matter if, you know, you could have a bedroom and you could be a teenager. I remember running out of space when I had all my collection in my bedroom and stuff. And then you get, yeah, you know, you get your first apartment or house or something, and then the collection room gets filled up. And, you know, it's a constantly evolving thing, you know. But then at the same time, it's our own problems. We're the ones who buy the stuff, you know. And, you know, if we didn't buy the stuff, Hasbro and Lucasfilm wouldn't make the stuff. So we only have ourselves to blame.
We definitely only have ourselves to blame. And if we don't get stuck into the news and we run out of time, we'll only have ourselves, yeah, to blame. So let's talk toys. Let's stay on the subject of toys. UK Toy Fair. It's taking place the 25th to the 27th of January. And they've announced that the event is taking place as a physical event. There was some doubts over it. They weren't sure. Last year, it didn't happen as a physical event. And just as a parallel to that, and it's in the middle of the year, it's in June, E3 has now been moved from a physical in-person event to an online event. And there have been other events happening, obviously. We've covered a lot on Fantha and the, yeah, stuff happening in the States and around the world. But it just made me think that if E3, and that's a huge show, I mean, so much news comes out of that event. If E3 has decided in June, which is still near as damn it 6 months away, to go online from physical, does that put Celebration, which is at the back end of May, does that put Celebration, which is also in California, does that put it in doubt? What's your gut feeling? Because we both mooch around the net and we see people talking and we all talk between ourselves as a team and such. What's your sort of spider sense telling you that the fate of Celebration is going to be this year?
Do you know what? That is such a tough one. Just this week, I've been speaking to those lovely, lovely, helpful people over at Showmasters to kind of arrange and get us booked, the Rebel Legion booked in for London Film Comic Con, which is happening at the end of February. It does raise questions. I think there's a certain level of maybe overcautiousness and knee-jerk reactions. I mean, obviously, I know we've now got the Omicron variant, which is, you know, a lot of people have caught, and it seems like it's turned out, at least for this variant, it's not necessarily the symptoms and, you know, isn't as severe, yeah, as previous variants and stuff, which is good. Actually, it's probably too early to tell, to be honest, I think. I guess you've got to look at probably other big conventions as well, like San Diego, because that will be, again, another good benchmark. But Celebration, I don't know. Maybe ask me again next month, I guess, and see if anything changes. Well, I mean, what's your gut feeling on that?
Yeah, no, very much the same. And kind of just as you're speaking, it's really taken me back to like this time last year.
Yeah.
We were having these conversations very regularly on making tracks about, you know, the effects of the pandemic and such. And it did feel like it was tailing off. And now it's come back, as you say, with Omicron, which doesn't, on the face of it, doesn't seem to be as severe. But then there's always the risk. Mm. And I don't want us to fall into that trap because we've been very clear about, you said at the end of most shows, wear your mask, get vaccinated, take your jabs and all that sort of stuff. So we don't want to fall into the trap of complacency. But by the same token, it does seem to be a less severe threat of the virus. But I was speaking to Adam O'Brien, Fantha Down Under Adam, on his show a couple of days ago, and they're having a terrible time of it in Australia. The conversation was very much of, yeah, this strain might not be so bad, but this is a variant already. Who's to say the next variant in August isn't a worse version? We really don't know. But talking about Celebration, Yeah, I've seen too many people online sort of wonder and question, and it is very quiet. They did announce the fan stage. They are taking panel requests, if you like, you know, for different panels and stuff. But outside of that, yeah, it does seem for sort of early January, with Celebration only 5 months away, very quiet. Now, Sod's Law says that on this week's episode of This Week in Star Wars, there'll be loads of Celebration announcements.
Yeah, of course.
So we'll come on next week and go, what were we worrying about?
You're completely correct. But I guess, like you said, it comes down to, and I think everybody needs to have that mindset, and I'm sure everybody at Read Pop is, because, you know, they're doing conventions over here and what have you. It's just wait and see. And I guess the problem is, I would imagine any guest announcements will maybe come fairly late in the day, because I'm sure, again, they've kind of put a caveat on, yes, I attend, yeah, assuming everything's okay or it hasn't got any worse than it is now.
There's a question, though. You say something really... No, you say something really interesting there, in that in terms of Celebration, especially Celebration, I know what I think about this, but do you think that the presence of a guest will determine, for the Star Wars crowd I'm talking, not the wider audience who might just go, oh, I fancy going to a Star Wars convention and just bobble up, oh, Mark Hamill's there, I'll do it because Mark Hamill's there, I've heard of him. But for the actual crowd that really gets stuck into the nitty-gritty or might be involved in running things or covering stuff like we do, obviously the Legion, what you guys do, do you think the guests are an essential element of that? Do you think they're a decision maker? I'm going anyway. It doesn't matter who the guests are. It's going to be fun and we're going to have a laugh and I'm going to buy some cool stuff and have a trip and a jolly and it's going to be an enjoyable time and it's a content creator for us as a site and all that malarkey. Do you think the guest is a key element of that?
I think it is. I think for some people, you know, such as yourself, like you've just said, you know, you're a man who's got many friends across the world, you know, from the Star Wars community, from the Star Wars fan community. But there's obviously going to be a lot of Star Wars hardcore fans who maybe don't necessarily know a lot of people from Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. So I would think so, yes. And I think also it does kind of create a legitimacy. I mean, if we take a look at the conventions that we have in the UK, let's look at, say, Telford. Telford had a lot of, like, signers. But then MCM Birmingham, they didn't. They had Hayden Christensen and Ian McDiarmid. And those are two big names. Let's be fair, that's only going to really appeal to either just the general autograph collectors or Star Wars fans. If you're a Doctor Who fan and you're an autograph collector for Doctor Who, man, you're not going to necessarily go to that convention because, you know, there's nobody there who's signing that's going to, you know, maybe pique your interest. So again, it's part and parcel, isn't it? Because if you have a signer, especially at Star Celebration, there's possibly going to be a panel with them as well. So therefore, there's an extra draw because you don't necessarily just get to meet them and get your photo taken with them. You actually get to sit down and listen to them have a chat about stuff with Warwick or whoever over in the US.
Yeah.
It is going to be a big draw. And I think Star Wars Celebration is the only official Star Wars convention put on by Lucasfilm. And so if you didn't have your autograph signers there, big names, I don't know, Felicity Jones, Mark Hamill, Daisy Ridley, or, you know, I'd imagine Hayden Christensen and maybe Ewan. I wonder if Ewan will be up for doing this year. If the big names don't go, then I think it's will maybe make it less appealing to a certain amount of people. And maybe this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because then maybe it just means that it'll be slightly quieter and everybody else can have more time to wander around and see stuff without feeling overcramped and swamped by lots of people. You get a bigger chance of getting the exclusives.
Oh, I like that logic. That's a good point. Yeah, let's do your idea. That makes more sense to me now.
When Mary Franklin was head of fan relations at Lucasfilm, we sat down and we chatted with her before Celebration Europe 2, and especially before Celebration Europe 3, and she was like, the big focus is, you know, it's for the fans, by the fans. So obviously, the draw is also the fan groups, such as Fan for Tracks and the 501st and the Rebel Legion and Mando Mercs. There's also what they can bring, you know, the Belgian prop builders and the guys who make all the massive, massive, epically big vehicles and stuff. It's not necessarily the be-all and end-all. Celebration is not just one thing or another thing. It's a combination of, like, many things all kind of rolled into one.
Hello, I'm Ahmed Best, and you're listening to Fan for Tracks.
So, at the back end of last year, a bunch of us Fantha Trackers were lucky enough to go down to Croydon to Smugglers Star Wars Charity Day. There was a whole bunch, I think there was about 24 or 25 Star Wars signers. We've brought you content from this event already on Making Tracks, and we did a 20-minute interview with Aidan Cook, who was behind so many characters in Rogue One and the sequel trilogy. We broke it into two halves. First half went out about 6 episodes ago, and this is the second half. It's me, Paul Naylor, from Start Your Engines, coming soon to Fantha Tracks Radio, I promise. Stood near the kitchen. It was really noisy, but what the heck, it's Star Wars and we were talking about all good stuff. So the second part of our interview with Aidan Cook.
show and tells.
Yes.
You know, to yes. impress the director and stuff. How often did you see something in a show and tell that yourself you thought this is going to be the one that's going to really nail it, or Neil might have thought this is going to be the one that's going to surprise you, and then all of a sudden it actually turns out to be the little creature at the back?
Because I was inside it, I couldn't really tell.
Sure.
Because literally, for most of the things, you had very little vision. You know, you get difficult to see, difficult to hear, difficult to breathe. Yeah. So you couldn't really tell which were the ones. But Two Tubes, for example.
Yeah.
And before Tony Gilroy came in, he was just one of the crowd.
Yeah.
When Tony came in, he went, "Oh, you know, can you do this? Oh, that's great. Well, come in here and say this and hold this and push her over there and grab him there." You know, and suddenly he went from just, you know, one in a group to that. I mean, Gareth had sort of made more of, in the stuff he'd released, made more of Space Monkey and POW and stuff like that. Yeah. When it came to the movie, you know, it was, for me, I mean, Two Tubes has been amazing because he's there, he's in Solo. And
that's right.
You know, so he's, so that was a real result for me. You know.
The Two Tubes that's in Solo, is that the same character?
Yes, it is. There was a mistake by... they put it out that it was Edrio, and in fact it was Benthic. So it was definitely, and the costume and the gun and stuff. So Edrio, Paul Casey, he has the pilot rig, and my one was the sniper who becomes Saw Gerrera's kind of right hand man.
So he lives for quite some time, mate.
He survives.
Yeah.
Because he's in the comics as
that's
well.
Right.
And he has a storyline in the comic describing his survival and turning really sort of badass, which is, I mean, it's an absolute gift, isn't it, really? You know,
she's a Jedi story.
It's a gift. You know, Boba Fett, who? We want to...
Exactly. Everyone should be getting their own series now, shouldn't they?
Boba job.
But you said about working on Willow, for example.
Yeah.
Which everybody knows it's coming and such. And working with Neil, there must be that nice, for him as well, that nice shorthand that you've worked together for so long.
Yeah,
that
I think
he's confident.
Yeah. I think within the core team, everybody has certain strengths.
Yeah.
And of the strengths that we have, it might be my imagination, but some of the roles he's given me, I feel incredibly privileged to have.
Yeah.
And they are, you know, the discomfort and everything of the costume, but they are actually proper acting roles rather than what I would call just wallpaper roles and stuff like that. And I've been incredibly lucky to have those and incredibly appreciative of them.
Yeah.
I also get roles where you are put in real sort of physical stress positions, like Boba Joe, like Tripto Bulbal in the casino and stuff like that. So I did have a bit of a reputation for being a bit a trooper as well, for being able to put up with physical discomfort. But I've also, you know, been blessed with a couple of real nuggets, as well. So,
sounds like there's a lot of self-discipline, physical discipline, to make these things work.
Yeah, I think, and every creature has its own requirements and necessities. And like with Boba Joe, you know, I'm walking around in a counterweighted sitting position, trying not to fall over forward, trying not to fall over backwards, not being able to see, you know, in whatever it was, 50 degrees in the shade in Abu Dhabi, you know. So you do train. You do have to, certain things you have to train for.
Regime.
Yeah, I have, I did, I mean, I come from a background which has included yoga, dance, gymnastics, so, which is why I ended up doing a lot of very physical acting jobs. And I have my own kind of routine of exercises drawn from all of those things. I'm not very good at doing exercise for its own sake. If I have a goal that I have to work towards, then that's really important. And my son Liam as well, he's super fit and super strong, but he will train specifically. He had that sort of giant mouse one in the last film, in the big Akiyaki sort of festival market, and JJ absolutely loved it, but he was dancing around in a sort of 40 kilo weight vest to be able to move that around in that heat.
As a father, you're very proud to see that.
Well, you know, it's great. You know, we did Jurassic World together, and you know, we did the VFX and a lot of the CFX sort of puppeteering sort of stuff as well. But the VFX stuff we had for the Indoraptor, we had a head and a tail, so that the people on set had something to act with, interact with. The cameras could frame the shots, the lighting. You know, the first gag was, "Oh, look, he really is following in your footsteps," because we're running around the set, you know. But then, you know, we'd take it in turns as to who would have the head and who would have the tail and stuff like that.
I bet it sat around the dinner table at night, you going, "We really can't believe what we're doing."
No, I mean, it is. It's tricky when you're not working and you don't know what's going on. You know, it is tricky. But then you look back at the stuff you've done and the places you've been, and it's what a privilege.
You've got a real appreciation. Yeah, for
I mean, clear, Jordan yeah. on the last thing was just absolutely mind blowing. Yeah. You know, mind blowing. And I mean, what a privilege that is. You know, I mean, going to Petra, going swimming in the Dead Sea, scoop. You know, it's like we were Liam and I were. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, as long as no one's listening. No, we had a Sunday off. We were climbing in the Wadi Rum. You know, it's like, wow. And we nearly didn't make it.
it's probably strengthened the bond that you've got.
Yeah,
you're working together. Yes. It's something that you both enjoy. Yeah, I take it he's a Star Wars fan as well.
But he's very much a sort of jack of all trades, Yeah, and he's come into it. I've come into it on the back of 40 years in the business, basically. You know, starting off literally getting my equity card as a dancer, then West End musicals, and then theatre, rep theatre, children's TV. You know, and it's sort of I've gone through the doors that have opened up to keep working. He's come in and go, well, we need somebody, you know. Oh, right. So we were doing.
Bring your son to work then.
Well, I was doing stuff for Millennium FX. So they had a big dinosaur. So I was performing their dinosaur for them. So, you know, we needed people to help come in and dress it. So he comes in to dress it. Then he gets in it. Then he starts getting the gig. And then he auditioned for the arena tour of Walking with Dinosaurs. And went then off all over Europe and Japan, you know, on this sort of major arena tour, you know. It's just, I mean, so much of it is luck. So much of it is luck, you know. I mean,
you make your own luck, don't you?
To a certain extent. But there's no question that, you know, having the ability to do the job is probably the basic requirement.
Yeah.
You know, having the luck to have somebody like Neil on your side.
Neil clearly believes in what we can do. I mean, there's probably a role comes along. I
think there is an element of that, as I say, because each creature has its own requirements. You go, well, you know, I know who'll be right for that, you know. And so, to be part of what I hope is his, you know, or I believe is his kind of core team, it's a real privilege.
So this Wednesday saw the release of Chapter 2 of The Book of Boba Fett, entitled The Tribes of Tatooine, which was directed by Steph Green and had a runtime of about 52 minutes. So it was a good long episode for this time. I think this episode, it could be fair to say, that doubled down not only on the action and the excitement, but also the flashbacks.
Yeah, and it made me smile that we did the group review on the site, which is out there now. And one of the things I wrote in my little piece was referring back to our episode last week, episode 121, where right at the end I said to you, what do you think's the A story? What do you think's the B story? Is it the flashbacks or the current stuff? And it really stood out this time that, I mean, it was a much longer episode, so your current stuff had a decent chunk of time anyway. But it really felt like the flashback was where the story was at in this one. I kind of feel now that it's going to flip-flop from episode to episode because it's setting up some really interesting stuff in the present, but there's all this really interesting establishing stuff in the past with his time in the Tuscans, and essentially it's a rebooted Boba Fett, isn't it? And there's loads of people online complaining that he's not the old Boba Fett and George wanted him to do this and blah, blah, blah. But I think with Fett, a character that, like Darth Maul at the end of Phantom Menace, they essentially drew a line under because in that moment they were gone and they did a Spock and brought them back, which was a creative choice. You are hitting the reboot button. Maul wasn't the same guy when he came back as he was before. Definitely Maul, but, you know, not the same guy. Things had happened. He had a different outlook on the world. Fett is so the same. And they really, in this episode, really, in a smart way, push that point across that this is the same guy. But he's not the same guy. Mm. You know, he's seeing things, he's learning things, he's kind of humble. He's still Fett. When he gets his blood up, he's still going to go. There's that Tosche Station scene.
Yeah.
Doesn't say a word, which I love because I don't like Fett talking too much. But this isn't the Fett that we've known for all these years. This is post-Sarlacc Fett. The only thing I can equate it to in the real world, I would imagine it's what it's like after surviving a terrible illness. You've got a second chance.
Yeah.
You know, there's before and there's after. There's this traumatic car crash style event that's happened to you in your life and you've got beyond it. So you're going to look back at your life and go, now I've got another chance at life. This is my second go. The experience has changed me and I think the experience has changed Fett. And we as an audience, if you're open to being receptive to following him as if almost like he's a new character, but you look at him and you go, that's Boba Fett, man. This is awesome. If you can sort of balance those two sides of the presentation, conversation, I think we're all going to benefit. I think we're only going to get cool stuff. What did you make of it?
To counter that point a little bit, and I think this is where maybe some people have had a hard time. I completely understand and completely get that notion of a traumatic experience has a way of giving you a fresh perspective and a chance to take a step back and review everything, take stock of what is important to you and what should be important to you. But it seems like there's not been that aha moment. There's not been anything like that. And I think for me, I kind of get where they're going. He's developing this sense of honor code, but I'm not quite sure where from. Does that make sense? Because it doesn't feel like it's coming from the Tuscans. For instance, you kind of almost would expect there to be a proper solid teacher moment where somebody like, the wise elder from the tribe would say, no, you've got to look at it from this perspective. You know, it's not about attack, it's about defense. I really do like these flashbacks, and I think what's going to happen is, whilst the present day story is, it's a slow taper up, it's a bit of a ramp up, I think. So it's going to start, and obviously with the introduction of the twins, with the two Hutt twins, I think that's obviously now, that's when we start to see where the stakes in the present day are going to be increased. And I think what will happen is we'll get to a cross point whereby the events of Boba's past and the flashbacks will start to take less precedence to obviously the future as things kind of progress. You're right. I think we probably only had the top 15, maybe 20 minutes max of this episode was in the present day. But, you know, it was a great flashback with some really cracking action set pieces. So you can't complain about that, I don't think.
It feels important that the flashbacks aren't just flashbacks, because sometimes you get flashbacks in shows and it's just like exposition. It's a mechanical thing. Instead of some character doing the Basil exposition thing and telling you as a narrative, they're just going to show it to you. And that's fine, because that's a device and that's fine. I mean, anyone who's just read War of the Bounty Hunters, and presumably Crimson Reign will be the same. You've got Fett in that time period between Empire and Jedi up to his worst day ever at the office sort of thing. He's the guy that we know from Empire and Jedi, especially Empire. He doesn't really do an awful lot in Jedi. His presence is there. His intent is there. You know he's there on reputation because Vader uses him. Vader wouldn't use him if he wasn't as good as we think he is. That gets missed a lot by people, I think. But now you've got a Fett who, like you say, I want to rule by respect, not fear. That's not the old Fett's way. So how do you get to that juncture where he makes that decision to do it, which is kind of what you've just said? We haven't seen that come to Jesus moment yet. You can only assess what we've seen so far, and we've seen two episodes. We've seen an hour and a half of the Book of Boba Fett, and it's probably, I don't know, the whole thing's probably 7 hours. So there's a lot more flashback and a lot more present to come.
Yeah.
The moment that's going to be really interesting, no idea where or when it's going to be. I don't know, pick a number. Episode 5, it's a 7-episode show. So episode 5 is where the past catches up with the present. We see Fett get to the point where we met him in the present tense in the first episode in Stranger in a Strange Land, and then the last two episodes are going forward, because now we know why he's doing what he's doing and how he got to the point where he got there. And but in this one, you mentioned the Hutt twins, you know, getting into the mechanics of the story. He's been noticed. Mm. There's a new Daimo and Tatooine. Even the mayor is sort of playing the game of, well, we all serve at your pleasure, that sort of tone. So he's managed to get himself into an important position. One thing that hasn't happened that I kind of thought might, but I think you can read it as the characters being a bit coy and not wanting to give too much away. Clearly, they all know who Boba Fett is. You know, he's been off the table, if you want to say that, for a few years whilst he's healing. And he's still healing because he's still doing the whole Bacta thing, which is a great device to give you the flashback. So I love that. But it's just interesting to see how they're responding to him. You know, the Hutt twins come along, the cousins, and they lay claim, and they're very firm. You know, the guy lifts the clapperboard thing up and shows the sort of the scroll thing. You know, this is the way it is. Fett's like, I don't recognise that. Bib Fortuna took it from Jabba, I took it from Bib Fortuna, it's all mine. If you want it, you have to kill me, you know, that whole thing. And then Blaxus Anton turns up, that was a great moment when he walked around the corner. Did not expect that.
No, absolutely. Double take. I was so happy and excited to see Blaxus Anton, because out of all the characters from the Star Wars comic book modern era, shall we say, to have him turn up as the enforcer for the two Hutt twins, was not expecting that. And it does give me hope, because I think she's a great character for all of her faults. It does give me hope that possibly we might see a live action version of Dr. Aphra at some point.
Yes.
It was so good. The fact that he had these two Hutts on that ridiculously, comically massive litter, because they keep on talking about, oh, I haven't heard your litter arrive.
Yes.
And then these
guys
kind of rock up with all these drums and stuff. And what I really loved about it was the fact that guys who are actually carrying it were still physically looking, you know, even though they've got CG huts on top of them, still looking like, we're gonna, you know, if you carry on talking and we don't start moving in a minute, we're gonna drop this thing because it's so heavy. And that was brave in itself to double down on the huts like that and give us two.
Yeah.
To be fair, they look pretty good as CG huts go. I mean, I guess the gold standard is always going to be Jabba from Return of the Jedi. You know, they don't have probably the budget or the time or the manpower to really do two realistic actual kind of like huts in that kind of respect. So I thought the CG huts were great. And what I quite liked is, again, it kind of doubles down on that whole mafia family kind of vibe that we're getting from the huts and the hut cartel.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
I thought the hoojib was fantastic.
Is that definitely a hoojib? I'm not sure.
Yeah, the hoojibs from the comics have great big floppy ears like rabbits, but definitely had the hoojib eyes.
Yeah.
And he had the single little antenna in the middle of his head. So I think it is.
I think it makes sense. I mean, the fact that he was using it just to put him up his brow just kind of goes to show just how minging and disgusting the huts are. But the one thing I'm so surprised about, and I guess this is possibly part of the analogy and part of the reason we've done it, is when you think about it, is that it seems like from the outside that Tatooine is just a dying sand ball of a planet. There's so much life teeming under the sand. The water in this episode kind of like makes his appearance and has a cameo. And we had the four-armed thing in the previous episode. And even the black melons, the fact, the actual source and the life force, shall we say, the one thing that's keeping the Tuscans alive comes from under the sand. So it's quite an interesting analogy about that, I think.
I mean, I love Tatooine anyway. I think most Star Wars fans love Tatooine. And there is the risk that you go there too often. But now in this, you've seen it in Mando, and it was great to get back to sort of the docking bay on Mos Eisley and all that sort of stuff. And now seeing it here, yeah, you're right. We're really exploring. There's a sense of geography, which I love. You know, there are maps of Tatooine. You see where the Jabba's palace is. And there was that great shot when the door opened when she was bringing the Nightwing assassin through the door. And you could see, you know, what the Gamorreans looked at when R2 and 3PO came in and Return of the Jedi was that beautiful vista. And you're thinking, wow, you imagine going up into the palace and looking out. That's probably got an incredible view. From there, you can probably see Mos Eisley and Mos Espa. Tatooine is not an enormous planet. There's a sense of geography that I'm really enjoying. But yeah, you're right. The wildlife, I've got to be honest, I wasn't madly taken with that Harryhausen creature last week. It felt too on that. It was obviously a nod to the Kraken.
A little bit too on the nose. Yeah.
Way too on the nose. And it didn't feel like a Tatooine creature whatsoever. My headcanon's telling me that's not of Tatooine. It was just there for some reason. But then you look at creatures on Tatooine anyway. Jubaks weren't originally from Tatooine. Banthas are found all over the galaxy. So I don't think they even know what the original home planet of Banthas are. Seeing the rock walk was great, and the black melon, like you say, makes all the sense, because that's another thing. I mean, that was touched on in Mando, wasn't it? And really double down on that, the source of water or source of moisture for the Tuscans, because they haven't got moisture evaporators. I love the Convey-X scene in Solo. So trains in Star Wars weirdly work for me. Never thought they would. Yeah, and this was another one where that was a great action sequence. Everything about that just looked cool.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that so far the show has done above all else, I think, is give us a completely 180 degree different perspective on the Tuscans. And I think this episode kind of really helps to reinforce that. I mean, these people, they're almost like the Fremen from Dune. Mm-hmm. I think if anybody's going to be the natives to Tatooine, I would have said it's the Tuscans. And I kind of feel maybe that might be where this is slightly headed a little bit. Either liberation of the Tuscans through Boba Fett, or a better understanding by the rest of the Tatooine residents as to, you know, the importance of the Tuscans to Tatooine, and also the fact, you know, it is their planet. You know, we had that nice kind of little campsite fire scene, actually it was in the tent, where the chieftain's kind of explaining about how, you know, there are different tribes, and, you know, and these ones have been fairly, you know, hidden, and, you know, not all of them kind of go out and kill, which is quite a nice way of explaining the fact that we've never seen this tribe before. So I'm really liking how the development of the Tuscan culture seems to be kind of progressing through the series, and also then how, as we're seeing, it's developing Boba Fett, and it gives us an explanation as to why he's walking around with like a gaffy stick. And that part of it, I've been pleasantly surprised by the whole of that we've seen so far.
Like you say, as a character, they always felt, or as a species rather, they always felt a little bit one note, didn't they? Certainly in the original trilogy, it was a cameo in Phantom Menace. Like the Jawa saying Utini, it was a nod to the past.
It's fan service, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, totally was. And in Mandalorian, they were off-world Jawas, but they're clearly still Jawas. Similar processes. it's made you think that, you know, for years, I mean, decades, you've thought the Jawas were the cute little scrappy ones and the Tuscans were the big bullies. And actually, it's the other way around.
Yeah.
The Jawas are the arseholes and the Tuscans are actually the misunderstood ones. So that's a great flip, I think, just as a broader Star Wars twist that makes all the sense in the world. It's all about perception.
Yeah.
You know, certain point of view is like Obi-Wan, isn't it? Certain point of view.
Absolutely.
You know, we're now seeing the Tuscans in a different light. And I love the fact that the chief, when they sort of sit in the big hut before he has the lizard go up his nose, was, we're a different tribe. We're not the same. You know, they're a different look and they're not as aggressive. And this is their part of the Dune Sea. And that was the scene I really loved. There wasn't a scene I didn't love in this, to be honest. Even Boba sitting on the bike, bouncing up and down with a grin on his face, which I can't imagine Boba forever grinning.
No.
But that scene was like, he was just trying to get point of view across. I thought it was great. You know, when Fett says to the pikes, this is their territory.
Mm.
You pay a toll to come through this. And for every one of them you kill, we're going to kill 10 of yours. And I take that back to your boss. And you better start walking before the suns go down. All of that was just wow. I mean, I don't know. Next week might completely contradict it. But my head's telling me right now as we speak, that Pike goes back and he relays that message directly to his boss and goes, this is the lay of the land in this part of the Dune Sea.
That whole kind of thing did make me kind of ask for questions like, what are the Pikes doing there? I understand the train, but I don't understand why they needed to use a train. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
To be fair, and if somebody just turns around and goes, well, because we wanted to put a train scene in it because we're kind of doubling down on the whole Western vibe and Lawrence of Arabia and stuff like that, I'd be like, okay, but obviously from a canonicity perspective, I was just like, you know, surely if you've got ships, you know, unless there's some kind of like spice processing plant on Tatooine, which there could be, you know, what is the purpose of this train? What's actually on the train? For me, that one carriage full of water is purely just for the Pike survival. We see them without their masks on and they're kind of like fish. So obviously fish literally out of water, you know, on the desert sands of Tatooine ain't going to last very long, no matter if they're wearing Star Trek Next Generation uniforms or not.
Yes. The only thing I can think of on that point of the train anyway is that I would imagine in Star Wars, not many vehicles touch the ground, do they? Most vehicles are off the floor, but most big haulage you would imagine is done by ships. But I'm just thinking in the Star Wars galaxy, it's probably airspace, you know, you need permission to fly through this area.
Yeah.
Than ground space, you need permission to drive through this area because it feels like they're a bit beyond that. But of course, in the case of the Tuscans, they're flying overhead. It's not bothering the Tuscans, is it? But if you're driving through the middle, it's directly causing a problem.
Yeah,
and you think, well, if they were flying over the head, if they were flying overhead, they could fly high enough that the Tuscans can shoot, but it's just going to bounce off the shields. But if they're driving through, and the Pikes clearly don't give a stuff about the Tuscans, clearly, I think that's what gets Boba's back up. So it's definitely a plot device to cause drama. But in the galaxy, I think the characters would look at that modes of travel in different ways. And there's probably more of a preciousness about airspace than there is about tracking along the ground.
Hello, I'm Dennis Lawson, and you're listening to Fanthatrax.
Toshi Station. Obviously, deleted scene from A New Hope. We saw it back in the day on Behind the Magic. Always kind of wish they'd been able to work it in, but it would have slowed the story down too much. So I get why they didn't. Now we finally get to go back to Toshi Station with the whole point of being there. And we see Cammy, and the actress they found to play Cammy really does look like who Stark did.
Didn't she did?
And I think a lot of people saw that shot in the trailer and thought that they'd sort of motion cap the faces onto the actors. But no, they've just cast it really, really well. What did you make of that scene? I love the fact that Boba didn't speak.
When I was first watching, I was like, oh, that's Cammy and Fixer. But then the fact that Fixer was so meek and didn't stand up to those bikers. And it's that whole thing, isn't it? Like, there's always a bigger fish. He would bully and he'd poke fun at like Luke Skywalker, call him Wormy and all that kind of stuff. But then actually, when there's some real badasses around, he's way over his head. So he just is really quite pathetic in the end, which I thought was quite cool.
In the storyline, he was there for multiple reasons because he saw the swoopers go past.
Yeah.
He gets the stick and the gun and he goes out with the permission of the tribal chief and heads towards Toshi Station. Fett had no knowledge of Toshi, probably knew nothing about it. We know it as fans, but it's just a bar, isn't it, essentially? It's where Luke got his power converters from. It's just a place to hang out. For us as fans, again, great to see Cammy and Fixer. That means something. The fact that they're alive means something. To have that sequence, it makes sense for Fett because he's, you know, he's not taking crap anymore.
No.
It's the start of the respect thing, but he's not there yet. So, you know, fear and violence is still working for him and he's trained by the Tuscans and he's probably got his blood up. And it was almost like when he came out the bar and he saw the speeder, it was almost like he took a look and thought, But logical head on, it's like he followed them there because he knows he needs the bikes because it's part of the plan to take out the train. He probably just looked and thought, hang on, why am I taking one bike? I'll take all of them. I'll just take all of them. You don't need to see it. It's not a cut scene. He goes back into the bar and goes, hey, have you got any rope? You know, and they give him some rope and he ties them all together and off he goes. So there was a practical reason for him being there as well as a really cool Easter egg. Yeah. And so for this, as fans, Black Kassantan, we've seen a Hoojib, for goodness sake. We've gone back to Toshi Station, which is OT fans is just glorious. Yeah. Mm. In A New Hope, we saw it, or the cutscenes, it felt like we saw it from the other side of the bar. It felt like we were looking from the opposite sides of the bar, which I liked. All of it just felt on point. Yeah, I was really, really impressed with this episode. In the present now, it's just nudging up because I think it's going to hit a tipping point where it's more the present than the past, but it's just giving us enough with the Hutt twins turning up, with Bobber and Fennec having the meeting with the mayor. Still not quite sure who actually hired the Nightwind assassin. What do you think about that?
Do you know, that is the biggest question from this episode. She looked a little bit nervous that he was back and a little bit surprised. So I don't know if that's because she put the Nightwind onto Fett.
There's definitely more to her, isn't there? Yeah. There's definitely more to her.
Or whether or not she just knew that was going to happen. The mayor of Tatooine is never probably going to be the most honourable of people, no. You know, mayor of Mos Espa. Maybe you think that he's probably got enough common sense to know if you're going to take out Boba Fett, you've got to make sure that you, one, you don't miss, and two, that it can't be traced back to you.
You say about how they would know that if you're going to take on Fett, you've got to know you're going to take out Fett.
Yeah.
And the Hutt twins come along in that great sequence and Black Kassantan comes out and obviously Kassantan and Fett have got a history,
we know indeed.
From the comics.
Yep.
And he refers to him as a gladiator, so he'd have to know that to call him a gladiator. So he clearly knows him. It feels to me that there's a lot of one-upmanship in the sense that they almost don't want to refer to each other by their name. It's almost like, yeah, I met you once. Yeah, I know who you are. As opposed to Black Kassantan, good to see you, or anything like that. It's almost like they don't want to give anything away. That feels like a very Tatooine thing. They all know who Boba Fett is. And it's almost like if they acknowledge that, yes, we know who you are, Lord Fett. Well, if you know who I am, you're not going to mess around with me, are you? So get in line now. It feels like there's a gang war coming. It feels like there's a conflict ahead. Hutt Space is north of Tatooine. If you're looking at the map, it's pretty much directly north. And Hutt Space is a great big sort of tract of space. It's a chunk of space. And Tatooine is a fair bit south of that, going sort of clockwise around the rim. But Tatooine, it's not within Hutt Space, but it's certainly within their influence because Jabba's there. So it's a key world in that sense for the underworld.
Mm.
You just know that the Hutt twins, they're not just going to wobble off and never come back again. We're going to see them again.
Yeah.
And if Black Kassantan's come along, okay, I feel like Aphra will come into it, I agree with you. Not as an offensive character, offensive as in attacking. She's always offensive because that's Aphra. She's always causing offence somewhere, but not, I mean, as an attacking character.
Yeah.
She flips sides like you flip a coin. And most of these bounty hunters will flip sides like you flip a coin. And this episode, Fennec, she was always there, but she was very quiet. And I'm still waiting, not expecting, but wouldn't be surprised if there's a turn where Fennec turns on Fett. We saw it in War of the Bounty Hunters. Fett had that little agreement with Dengar and like that, he turned on him.
Yeah.
These characters are so used to turning on each other. It's almost like, it's not that they forgive or forget, they're just used to it.
It's business.
So I'm just waiting. Yeah, it's business. I'm just waiting for the turn.
I mean, I wonder, now that Santi's there, Big K, as Aphra's referred to him as well in a few places, I wonder if this is what drives the scenes that we've seen in the trailers of the sit-down with the other crime bosses, because I'm guessing Fett's like, you don't want to have to lose your territory to the Hutts. So if, you know, if we all band together, and also if there's a Wookiee, and, you know, Trandoshans hate Wookiees as much as Wookiees hate Trandoshans, then that's maybe what we're going to see in the next episode or episode after that. There's going to be some showdown. Fennec and Boba, you know, with two semi-skilled Gamorreans, don't really have the enough firepower
the
to
clout.
Kind of, they definitely don't have a clout, so they're going to need to make those alliances, which I guess is what we're going to see maybe in this week's episode or the week after.
It's great because it set up so many questions for next week, but that's the beauty of Star Wars, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, what if this happened and what if that happened? Like Gwala Fripp, she's definitely more than just the hostess at the bar.
Yeah, totally.
It's clearly an important place because the mayor sends him there. A little part of me thinking the mayor's more on side than we think.
Yeah.
Because the Hutts are a threat to everyone, aren't they? And I'm sure it's more profitable for these people without the Hutts than it is with them.
Because you can imagine that, like, the Hutts will probably just impose some really heavy tariffs, protection rackets, and every now and again expect that we're going to burn your bar down so we can kind of claim the insurance.
Yeah.
This series more than any other from the Disney Star Wars era. Yeah. It's definitely doubling down on that notion of a singular story. You take the Mandalorian, and it was still very, even though we called it chapters, it was still very episodic.
Yeah.
This feels like this was two chapters from a 40-chapter book. When we finally get to see the whole 7 or 8 episodes of Book of Boba Fett, it will read and it will flow like a proper chapterized story, which is fantastic. It means that actually, you know, those who posted online after the first episode, like, this is not for me. How often would you close a book after the first chapter? You wouldn't. You maybe give it the first 10 chapters. But by that point, it's like, well, I might as well see it to the end.
Well, it's like listening to a new album, isn't it? The new Maiden album comes out. You listen to the first two tracks and go, I don't like them. I'm going to listen to the rest of it.
Yeah, exactly. I'll see it through. I want to see what's the rest of it's going to happen. Okay, so let's leave the Book of Boba Fett there for this week. But I'm sure we'll pick it up again next week, no doubt. So before we head off into the Twin Suns, Mark, can you let the good listeners know how they can get in touch if they have a question, a comment, a theory, or a complaint?
Yes, I can, Mark. If you want to be a part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, visit FanthaTracks.com or check out the free FanthaTracks app through the App Store to follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. We've not had a listener's question for a while because obviously we're digging into Book of Boba Fett, but that doesn't matter. Still send the questions in. We'll get to them during the run of the show if we can, or we'll bank them for later on. Send them in. We definitely want them. Comment, like, and share on any of our social media feeds at FanthaTracks, and be sure to subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semple for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our Making Tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Remember, tune in to our FanthaTracks news show, Good Morning Tatooine, live most Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, on Facebook and YouTube. And that's me done for this episode.
Yay! Get out of here.
Get out. I'm going.
Look after yourself, matey. No doubt. I will speak to you during the week. But for everybody else, thank you so much for listening. As always, we do appreciate it. You know, if you want those conventions to keep on happening, stay safe, keep masked, get vaccinated or boosted. And remember, Black Castanzen is where it's at. May the Force be with you.
Coming up next on FanthaTracks Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.